13 through 19, and I'd ask that you'd follow along with me. That's Deuteronomy chapter 25. And that's verses 13 through 19. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Let's pray together. Lord, we ask that you would give us lessons here. Although ancient, within these case studies are the very essence of what it means to be human, what it means to be a Christian. And so we ask, Lord, that you would teach us. We ask that you would be glorified. We ask that you would overcome the ways in which we can be blind to truth. And yet you would do so through your Spirit. In the name of Christ, amen. Amen. You may be seated. Have you ever heard the saying that we are about a decade behind Europe? That whatever is happening there now is where we will be culturally in 10 years? Something along those lines. In the past, the Swedish churches, some of them, have decided to, as many of our churches within the States, give loyalty to the LGBTQ movement. Interestingly, one LGBTQ advocate, she's a lesbian artist, decided to put those churches to the test. In other words, it's really easy to say that you support something in word, and it's much more difficult to follow up your words with actions. So this artist wanted to see if the churches were really on board. And so lesbian artist Elizabeth Olsen Wallen painted a piece entitled Paradise and challenged a local church to place it up front. The painting shows the Garden of Eden. I can show you the picture afterwards if you'd like. Yet instead of Adam and Eve in the garden under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil eating an apple, the artist instead took out that vision and included same-sex couples, man and man eating an apple together, woman and woman eating an apple together, and up in the tree is a transgender serpent. The painting is a sure sign that Christ has put out the lampstand of that church, resorting back to Revelation. But I did find, as I sat there and just kept staring at the painting, that Christ was giving me insight by looking at it. It actually became one of the most useful things that I had experienced in the year of 2019. Because what it did for me for the first time was, instead of just having a bunch of random news facts about the evolution of a movement, I was finally able to see, in light of Western and Eastern philosophy and political theory, where a group of people stood. The painting lets us know that the LGBTQ movement is nothing less than a vision for humans, what humans are meant to be, and for society as a whole. That was insightful for me. It brings us to a question.
Are you aware that you are an envisioning animal? That you really can't help it? That each one of you here, whether you recognize it consciously or not, you have a vision for life? And you are a part of perhaps another person's vision that has started. Some political movement, some philosophy is more appealing to you than another. And I'll just ask you this morning, what is your vision? Let me ask another question that's not very popular these days because we don't exactly think this way any longer. What is your vision for society? What is your vision for how human beings relate and how certain human beings could relate? Do you have a vision? Or do you live in the moment with no vision, eating and drinking and being merry, and then you die? Because that in and of itself is caught up in a vision that says there is no vision. That's how entrenched this is as a part of being human. Well, our time in Deuteronomy, well, we're back from Revelation, and we're back into Deuteronomy. Our time in Deuteronomy has been a time of catching God's vision, not just for the individual, but for society as a whole. Through each case law that we have examined, God has been engaging with our ethical imagination, and He has been displaying before us a kingdom and a vision for human society. Well, that continues this morning, and we have two scenarios before us. And I do want you to keep that question in your mind. What is your vision for society and for the human race? You could start small if you want, for your individual relationships or for your family or for your church. But what vision do you have? And what is the vision that Deuteronomy has been giving to us? Well, we have a more of the vision fleshed out here this morning, under two main parts. I hope you noticed that the break there, it was about weights and measures, and then there was this section there, that the obvious break into remembering Amalek and the Amalekites. So let's look at those two things and continue discovering God's vision for humanity and human society, really for His kingdom. So we begin here in chapter 25, verse 13, with differing weights, heavy and light, and differing measures. Over this series, we've seen, and this is a continuation of that, that love is very specific. Here, the specific form of love takes place in a business transaction. And the scenario involves verse 13, weights, and then if you look at verse 14, it mentions a different word, measures. Now, weights are one way in which you can determine how much food a person gets, and it's the same thing with measures. And we have this, we don't talk like this exactly, as you see within this ancient context, but we have the same kind of thing. Food is sold by weight every day. When you go to the grocery store, the chicken or the beef will be measured out by pound. I mean, you don't get 2 liters of beef. I guess you could, but it would be kind of weird. It sounds weird even saying it. Instead, it's by the pound. And so, for example, those of you who are curious, I just was looking yesterday at advertisements. Aldi right now has fresh lamb loin chops, and they're advertised at $7.99 a pound, just in case you want to get some for me for New Year's. Well, that's the weights. Well, there's also measures, and measures in the context here has to do with how our foods would be sold by volume. In this case, it would have been a bowl that you would have put flour in or grain or whatever it is. And in our culture, we have liters or gallons or cups or ounces, and you can see this across the grocery store. For those of you who want to have a New Year's resolution to be unhealthy, Aldi is also advertising 4 2-liter Cokes for $5. And that's according to liter, which would be measure. So the scenario in this passage, taking those weights and those measures as the way to engage our ethical imaginations. He doesn't want us just thinking about pounds or liters. He wants us to engage with our ethical imaginations. The scenario in this passage is forbidding changing those weights and those measures for dishonest gain. The weights in the ancient world would have been little stones, and you could keep those stones within your pocket or you'd have them in the marketplace.
And there would be an etching on the stone. For our culture, it would say the number 1 pound. Let's say that, for example. And it would be written on the side. And you would place the stone on the scale, and then you would fill the other side up with the food until it was perfectly balanced, and then you knew that you got 1 pound of food. Well, here the warning is those who are dishonest, that you would chisel a 1 pound mark on a stone that was only half a pound, or however that would work. You can see the point there. And at the end of the day, the business owner would increase their wealth and still have a good stock of inventory by way of cheating individuals through unjust weights and measures. I think you get the picture. And if you truly get the picture, which will take much meditation on your part, you're not going to be just stuck thinking about gallons and pounds. You're going to be thinking of the ways in which this imaginatively spreads out into all of our existence. Remember that situations like this, I like to think of this situation under the ninth commandment. It's meant to engage our imaginations. God gives us one case study, this case study, in order to imaginatively consider what is God's heart like with how he deals with people. And how may we grow to have similar hearts by his grace? In other words, we're called to be honest. That's what the ninth commandment is about. And here is an example in which that could take place in society, but is not limited to that example. That's not how this law works. This passage, in fact, is way more than about just honesty. Although it is asking you to put the honesty lens on and look out at all of human life through the lens of honesty. It's really about, though, all of the case laws at once. I want you to take a look more closely at this passage with me, and I don't want you to miss this in verse 15. It says, "You shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure." Now, this is pretty poetically expressed, if you look at the way that everything is balanced out with the language. And I particularly want you to notice the word just there. Just weight, just measure. Here we have, just as we had in chapter 16, a repetition of the word tzedek, or that's the Hebrew word for righteousness. Does that bring up anything in your mind that we've been going through in all of the case laws? It is, in effect, through this poetic trope, saying righteousness, only righteousness. It is repeated once again, just like we saw within chapter 16, verse 20, and you know what that does. If you're in Sunday school class, you should immediately recognize what this does. It provides us with an inclusio, or a bookend. In other words, and some of you are going to be very thankful for this, although I hope that you'll grow out of that immature thought, this is the end of the case laws. This is the final one and the summary of them all. This is the bookend of everything that we've been studying through each one of these scenarios. And thus we have a kind of summary present under the perspective of honesty. All of the case studies that you've heard can be considered underneath of this perspective. Rules governing kings, cities of refuge or safety, witnesses in a court of law, laws of concerning warfare, unsolved murder, war brides, rebellious children, adultery, fornication, exclusion from the congregation and worship, protection of women from jerks, protection of the poor and the widow. In one sense, you may see all of these case laws as about honesty. And you could actually do the same thing with each of the commandments, using them as a lens in a kind of multi-perspectival way at looking at man's ethical life through the eyes of God. In one sense, you can see all of the case laws as about honesty, and you can ask this question: am I dealing with others, who they are, their stage of life, their situation of life? Am I dealing with them with honest wisdom and with honesty? It's the question that we are to be raising from this case study. You see how it starts off with just weights and just measures, but after you meditate on it for a while, you begin to start to blossom out into this kind of flower of thought. In other words, do I deal righteously with my God and with my neighbor? That's the question, because it's tzedek, tzedek. Just as it had mentioned in chapter 16, verse 20. The emphasis really, I'll go one step further. It's interesting because the case laws, they all speak to each other. They all interact with one another. And so you have to pay attention to which case law is next to which one, and there's plays on words. Well, it's very interesting to me, and you may find this actually amusing. I find it certainly one of the most memorable illustrations that I've seen within Deuteronomy. To understand honesty even further and to have a picture of it, just as Jeremiah gave us a picture of love this morning with a dog and rawhide. That is interesting, Jeremiah. Thank you. So too, we're going to have a picture here in a moment to really get at the heart of what it means to be an honest person and what happens if you are dishonest. The emphasis, even more so here, in this case of honesty with just weights and just measures and asking how do I deal with people and who they are honestly, the emphasis is actually a little bit more particular in this context. It's towards those who are vulnerable in society. And so we can ask a further question. Do I deal honestly with those who are vulnerable in society? Do I support work done in society to where those who are vulnerable are honestly dealt with in dignity? Verse 11 and 12, I did not read to you. I'm just going to go ahead and read that yourself this morning, are an illustration of a dishonest person. The picture is of a woman, by taking advantage of the vulnerable part of a man, dealing dishonestly with him. And you could say that across society, if you are dishonest, you do the same to those around you. And we have expressions in our culture that say, I really feel like I was just, and then you finish the sentence. It is an unforgettable image on purpose. You are to deal honestly with each other, especially the vulnerable. Now, this last comment on the vulnerable is a transition to the case study with Remember Amalek. There's a continuation, really. That illustration of the woman who fights dishonestly then moves us, you're supposed to carry that thought with you into that perfect and just measure, and you're supposed to continue to rain down into this next point, which is to remember Amalek. And that begins in verse 17. And so we have weights and measures as a way for us to consider the ninth commandment and what it means to be honest and the kind of questions we're supposed to be asking ourselves. And then we have remember Amalek, which is going to help us in honesty and dishonesty towards those who are vulnerable. And that begins in verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, and he continues there. Now, this should be familiar to you, verse 17, because we've already run across this story in Deuteronomy, and it is present within Exodus. Later on, it says that Amalek should be wiped from the face of the earth, basically, or from under heaven. You see that in verses 17 and 18 and 19 there, where it's leading in verse 19, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. We've heard that before under the law of Harem. Do you remember the law of Harem, that they were to be utterly destroyed? Now, let me ask you a question. What you see here in our passage this morning, is it an exact repetition of the law that we heard earlier about Harem, about wiping out in war? You have to pay careful attention to the scenario, and if you notice in verse 19, it says, when the Lord your God has given you rest. This is not about going into war, this is after war, and that makes a pretty big difference. This is a scenario, by this time, after the war is over. And thus, what you have here is a command to erase any artifact, any artwork, any philosophy, any story, anything which is symbolic or supportive or of Amalekite society. That's essentially what's going on here. It is a complete subversion of anything that society would have put together. In other words, the Israelites were to actively subvert and hate, that can be very surprising for us to hear, a command to hate, but not in general, a very particular society. Now, why do you think that is? I mean, you could say it's not. This is just placed in the Bible somehow, and it's not really a good representation of who God is and how he thinks about things. But in the other case laws, we turn to other places where we know that it is something that everyone agrees upon, that it's a representation of God, and he's still hating the wicked. He's still removing them from the walls of the heavenly Jerusalem, and they remain outside as a symbolism of his hate. So I don't think that that's a good explanation of this, to just cast aside what it says here and say it doesn't really say that. I mean, you could say that God just hates certain ethnic groups, and he's God and he can do whatever he wants, but that would not be paying attention to any of the clues that are present within the passage. And in fact, it's actually contrary to the very nature of God, because God the Father through the Son is offering presently mercy and love to every tribe and tongue and nation without favoritism. And so I think we should look at verses 17 and 18 for the answer, because it's actually provided there for us as exactly what is going on here and why there can't be any support of the society that Amalek ran. Moses calls the people to remember the actions of Amalek, verse 17. Notice when they were coming out of Egypt. Now look at this national story that he is telling. It forms their identity and the actions that will come out of them as a society. You can find this sacred history that he's talking about in Exodus chapter 17, verse 8. And as Moses, do you remember the story? Moses was holding up the rod and they would begin to defeat the Amalekite army. But if his arm started to fall, they would start to lose. And so he had people holding him up with the rod. That is the same story. As Moses held up the rod of God in his hand, and that's the emphasis, the rod of God, showing that God is winning the victory, the Israelites conquered Amalekites. Now that's a summary of Exodus. But you know what is interesting is there are facts within this Deuteronomy account that are not present in the Exodus account as to what happened in that time with Amalek. Notice the details. Amalek chose to attack. If you continue reading in verse 18, he chose to attack all of the people in the rear ranks. Notice the emphasis throughout this text here in Deuteronomy of the repetition of who he attacked. Take a look at it with me. He met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks. Okay. Now he's going to say it all over again, but it becomes more and more vivid with each phrase. All the stragglers at your rear. It's not good enough. Let's become more particular and vivid. When you were tired and weary. So the weary and the tired. And then it says, ultimately, this is because he did not fear God. Do you see the picture of the historical reality of the way that this society had cultivated their soldiers and the results against the Israelites? A long train of people traveling through the Red Sea, they finally make it free from slavery. Perhaps hundreds of thousands of people heading through. Guess what would happen over time, especially if you had been in slavery for a while? As you kept going, marching in the train, one foot after the other, what would happen? Who would begin to start to fall towards the back? And who would remain in the front? It would be the elderly, right? I mean, if you were to put my son Jack in a group of people and say, we're going to walk through this desert, and if you're elderly, you try keeping up with Jack. Going through the desert. Go ahead. Good luck. I can't keep up with the kid. And that's a picture that we have here. What about the small children who have to stop and play with everything? Or who are saying, are we there yet? What about those who are in their third trimester? What are those who are carrying small? What about those who have large families and have to carry small children? What about those with disabilities? What about the blind? What about those who are lame? That's the picture, is they drop back, still amongst their people. They're going to make it to the promised land. But then you have trained soldiers starting to pick them off, perhaps one by one or dozen by dozen. What kind of army has a society where the young men and women are taught to destroy the women and the children first, and the elderly and the disabled. Do you see why there's rules in war? It's a reflection of what you could become, the evil that you could become as a human being, to have no rules at war. With verses 11 and 12 still in mind, because I believe that it is a dominating image, Amalek hit Israel below the belt in the worst way, slaughtering the women, slaughtering the children, slaughtering the elderly, as it says here in this passage, slaughtering the stragglers, slaughtering the tired, slaughtering the weary. And thus the whole world with the Amalekites and the command here to continue to blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven is one continued piece of the larger picture that we have seen from the beginning. And that verse 11 and 12 is still the dominating illustration. God's people do not support societies, their religions, their philosophies, and their practices, and their visions, which take advantage of the vulnerable. God's people do not support societies that put the elderly on the sidelines and give them no honor. God's people do not support societies which murder unborn children. And the philosophies and the stories and the myths that go along with it to motivate to continue down this line. Instead, we have a society that gives each person their due and their dignity. You know why? Because this passage says we deal with people honestly. And we have learned so much about how we are to be relating to those who are disabled or vulnerable in any way and how much dignity they have. If you are a widow, you are not a burden on society. You deserve special treatment in society. A true widow, one who has been entertaining strangers and giving up her life sacrificially for the people of God, that's how it's defined by Paul. That's what it looks like to deal honestly. There was an entire society of people that did not deal honestly. And it lets you know what it means to truly be a liar. This is the working out of all lies. It's what it means to be a dishonest human being. It's this picture here. And you've got an illustration in 11 and 12 as to what it feels like for us to be around you if you are a liar. And you see the results if it takes over an entire society and the kind of things that are possible. Remember that the Amalekites are those same group of people that sacrificed children to their God. So the Israelites' children, I guess, killing them was no big deal. So that's what we have here in our case studies. And our case studies have basically come to an end. If you look in the rest of the passage, you're going to see that we have a section on liturgy, and then we're going to get into Moses' song, curses. We're coming to the end of the book here. There's much, much, much more meditation, comparing and contrasting the case laws as you develop in Christian wisdom. That's what it means to grow in wisdom. It's to grow in righteousness. And it begins with knowing what it is. We can see all of the case studies here in this passage through the weights and the measures. And we can see all of the case studies and the subversion and the hatred of unjust society like the Amalekites. And it lets us know that our life consists of love and it consists of hate. And that's a profound thought that I'd encourage you to keep going down. We are to love righteousness, only righteousness. And we are to hate unrighteousness, especially toward the vulnerable. Now, I want to return, like I said, I want to return to the introduction. Remember I said, I want you to keep that question in mind. Do you have a vision for society? Do you have any kind of vision whatsoever? I want you to return to that introduction of the painting entitled Paradise. It depicted a societal vision from the LGBTQ perspective. It's just one perspective. There's thousands of them out there derived from different philosophies that have come across the face of the earth over the ages. I want you to do this. I want you to enter into a little project with me. I want you to imagine that your vision of life, whatever it is made into a painting.
The vision for your life, it cannot be about the things that you say. It can't just be your words. It actually has to be a vision that is painted on the canvas based on how you actually live your life and how you function. It has to be, in other words, a painting of your actual life, your actual vision. And it has to be done, here's the further limitation, and I look forward to hearing what you come up with. It has to be done with the Garden of Eden. You have to take the landscape of the Garden of Eden, and you have to use Adam and Eve, the characters that are present in the story, and the landscape, and you have to modify it symbolically to represent exactly what your vision is for your functional and actual life. Now, if you were to do that, what would the painting look like? What would Adam and Eve be doing? And what is the role of the serpent? Now, if you watch movies and you ask this question, you'll see that almost everyone is commenting on this. They're all kind of painting their own picture. Let me give you some twisted examples that we tend to come up with as visions for our own life. Let me ask you this. In your painting, your actual life, not the lip service that you give, would Adam and Eve be standing under the tree staring at their iPhones? I'm not saying that that's what you do all the time. It's a symbol of kind of like the ethos of your life, that you're kind of lost in a virtual wonderland, making no real connections to the people you could actually see and touch. I don't know that that's you. I'm just giving you an example. Here's another one. Would Adam be sitting and watching TV while the wife does all the work? Would that be... Can you see the canvas? Can you see the recliner under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the wife doing everything, taking care of the whole garden while he catches the latest football game or whatever? Or what about this one? Imagine this canvas, real big. Adam, and he's dead center. And all around him are his new toys. He's got a new car, a new TV. He's got a motorcycle. He's got a virtual reality machine. All of his toys. And the perspective is perfect on the canvas because you see way in the distance in the painting, all the way off on the horizon, is a little tiny wife and children that have nothing to do with his situation. Those are some possibilities. And we all actually know, although they would never live up to that characterization in full, these are characterizations, we know that some people's paintings would basically come out that way. Now I want to ask you this. If the vision of Jesus Christ was painted and what he is actually doing in time and space, what would the painting look like with the same characters and the landscape? And it's almost a perfect match, is it not? It is a perfect match because he's considered the new Adam. Would it not be of Christ, the new Adam, using his power and wisdom to love and to deal honestly with Eve and their family? Isn't it a vision of treating people with dignity and dealing honestly? Is that not the picture painted of what Christ actually does, despite what people say about him? Is that what he's not doing in time and space? Is that not the painting of his life, his death, and his resurrection? Isn't it a vision not only of justice, but of mercy? The interesting thing is that this is beautiful. You know, it keeps occurring to me as I look across our society at our stories, our movies, our novels. Although there's some trash in it, there's something that tends to be a part of it where people really are wanting this good, the true, the beautiful, protection, nurture, basic things like that. And we see here, if we pay attention closely, that the portrait of Christ and what he is doing provides all of those things. His vision for society is beautiful. His power to establish it is true. And it helps us to understand what it means to be a Christian as we enter into the new year and what Christianity is all about. If someone stopped you on the street and they asked you, what does it mean to be a Christian? What would you say? And would you not appeal to what we're talking about now as the ultimate vision for what Christianity is? What does it mean that Jesus Christ had a life and has a life? Why did he have to die? Why was there a resurrection? Why did he ascend to the highs? Why did he send his Holy Spirit? Is it just a bunch of philosophy and abstract theology? Or is he seeking to accomplish, and he will accomplish, something in time and in space? A vision for society. His society, called the church. The only way to make sense of any of those things that we see within the scriptures is to see them in the larger total vision of his kingdom, heaven coming to earth. And Christ is in fact establishing his vision. He is in fact establishing his vision. What is the picture? Christ as Adam, providing and leading his bride, the church, into glory, as we heard on Christmas Eve. And that leads you to an ultimate question. You know, when we deal with the scriptural categories as a kind of table of contents or categories for life, you really can become uncomfortable pretty quickly. You're either going to end up being in the vision of Christ and what he is accomplishing through his kingdom, or the vision of Amalek. Those are the only two choices. And so that is the question that is posed to you this morning. And I'll say it in a very unpopular way. Have you joined the church? Because if you are outside of the church, then you're with the Amalekites. If you have joined the church, if you have seen your sin and sought Christ for forgiveness, but not just forgiveness, transformation, then let us keep in step with Christ's vision. Let us start by seeing, what would we have painted on that portrait of our actual life? Maybe ask a friend over lunch, if you had to paint my life with those characters and that landscape, what would it look like? Ask someone that's not afraid to be frank with you. And if everyone is afraid of you, ask me, because I'm not afraid of you. But whatever it takes, as we enter into the new year, let us keep in step with Christ's vision, perhaps first by recognizing that there is a vision for the future. We are so cynical within our society that we no longer believe truly that there is any vision for the future, that all we have are our moments today and then we die. That is an adoption of a vision of social Darwinism and has nothing to do with Christianity. If you have not joined the church, if you have not seen Christ in his glory and how he can forgive you from his sin, if you have not humbled yourself before him, then I plead with you to turn to Christ by joining his church. Join the only winning society, the only society that will truly bring heaven and earth together, where truth and justice will meet. They will kiss, and it will be beautiful. There will be no more tears. Let us turn to Christ and embrace him, dealing honestly with each other today, bringing heaven into earth, embracing Christ's vision of paradise. Please pray with me.